You're listening to Leverage.
To Leverage.
To Leverage.
An ASA Studios production.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Leverage, ASA's podcast on the politics of aging. We have joining us today as host Alan Gutterman, who, among many things, is a best-selling author, business counselor, independent scholar, human rights activist, gerontologist, and member of ASA's Public Policy Committee and Ageism and Culture Advisory Council. Our guest for today is Dr. Michael Smyer, the founder and CEO of Growing Greener, Climate Action for a Warming World, senior fellow in social innovation at Babson College, former provost, and an emeritus professor of psychology at Bucknell University, national expert and author, including an ASA Generations Journal article, The Climate Crisis, What's Aging Got to Do with It?, where he explores the intersectionality of an aging population and the climate crisis, and how older adults can be the leaders in climate change versus the victims by linking hope to action, which is what we will be discussing today.
Thank you, Victoria, and Mick, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it. Very much. I got interested in putting together, helping to put together these podcasts from the Generations Journal articles that came out in summer of 2022. And I would recommend the entire edition to everyone listening. It's a great collection of materials covering a whole range of topics relating to older persons and climate change. And for me, was a great introduction to many of the issues and what folks are doing, aspire to do, and that sort of thing. And Mick's article in particular, Mick was instrumental in putting together the table of contents, if you will, and introducing the works of the other authors and everything, provides a great introduction to some of those issues. And we're going to talk about those, some of those today, as we go through things. I'm going to give Mick a chance to talk a little more about his background and how he came to his interest in the topic and what he's doing today and everything beyond the bio that you've heard. But before I do, I just wanted to share a little bit of a personal story, because I believe that for big issues like this, sometimes it's easier to start where you are and look around your own life and to put things into perspective and everything. I am in Oakland, California, which is across the bay from San Francisco. My story is this. You know, a couple of days ago, I was driving close by here going to an appointment, and it was raining very, very hard, very, very hard, very windy, that sort of thing. Atypical, but typical of the last few months here. And I was driving down the street and looked off to my left. And as I was driving down the street, there was this group of maybe 300 or so people walking down the street in the pouring rain, and they were protesting fossil fuels, and they had their signs out, and they were walking slowly, and everything like that. And I looked, and they had placards, and the placards were for a group called Third Act. Now, Mick may speak more to Third Act. Third Act is one of the climate activist groups that's focusing on getting older persons involved in climate action and everything. And in fact, several of the articles in the Generations Journal talked about Third Act, and the founder of Third Act is one of the authors in the series as well. But I confess, I had not seen this before. And suddenly there they were. You know, that was the first time I'd really noticed that type of thing, in around here at least. And then I went to my appointment, and I was speaking to the nurse practitioner, and she said, "Well, you have any appointments coming up that you know want to be careful of. And I said, well, I'm doing a podcast on Thursday. And she said, oh, what on? I said, well, older persons and climate change. And she stopped gracefully and said, oh, what's that? So this conversation began about it. And I tried to explain. I was going to take it aback and make these explanations. I said, well, you know, there's kind of at least two ways to go at it. You know, one is impact of climate change on older persons. And I said, well, think Katrina. On the other side was, of course, climate action and that sort of thing. We had a really good conversation, and she seemed to really get it and seemed interested in it. And, you know, bless her heart, and was engaged with it and everything, which made me thinking about how intergenerational conversations on climate change and climate action are so important. The half hour was interesting because it suddenly brought up all these issues about relevant to what we're, you know, kind of talking about today and what's talked about in the article and everything like that. So I guess I'd say, if nothing else, learn from what we talk about today, and then hopefully go away and just kind of look around your house, look around your neighborhood, look around your community, and you'll see some of these things as well. So thank you for listening to my personal story. And let me ask now, Mick, if you could tell us a little more, before we get into the article, tell us a little more about, you know, from your background and how you got to this space.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me, Alan. And Victoria, thanks for that nice introduction. And I loved your story, Alan, because your takeaway, which is start where you are, is perfect, because I think that's really what we each have to do. And I'm going to come back to several elements in your story as in our conversation. But you asked, how did I get into this? I'm a newcomer to climate change and aging. I've really had kind of three careers. I've been a gerontologist my whole career, studying the psychology of aging, aging and mental health. So I'm a card-carrying gerontologist. I had a second career as an administrator, a dean or a provost for about 25, 30 years, helping run universities. And in my line of work, when you do that, you get time off for good behavior. So we call it a sabbatical, right? And so I had a sabbatical when I stepped down as provost at Bucknell. And I thought to myself, well, I want to work on something important. What's important? Oh, climate change. Well, what do I bring to that? I'm a psychologist. And I said, well, I bring old people. I study aging. And there are two global patterns going on, right? Population aging and climate change. And I naively thought at the time, I'll just join the hundreds of other people who are already looking at the intersection of those two. After I talked to all six of them, I realized, you know, there aren't a lot of people working at that intersection, and this would be a good topic to really focus on. And that's what I did over the next couple of years on sabbatical. I spent time at the Stanford Design School, which really helped me take my ideas and move them into a format that could use psychology to move people from anxiety to action on climate issues, particularly older adults. And that's really where I started about 7 years ago now. And over the last several years, we've been refining those approaches and working my way down the lifespan. I started working with older adults, and the project was originally called Graying Green. And I love that title, gray, green, good. But as we started to work with college students and with high school students, the feedback we kept getting was, this gray stuff, we don't want to hear about it. Don't call us gray and green. So that we changed the name of our project to Growing Greener. And so now we go by the name Growing Greener, which seems to work across the lifespan. So now we have approaches that work with the full range from elementary school kids through older adults in their 90s and beyond. And we can talk more about that as we get into it, Alan. But I really came to this very late in life. My own climate journey really started in 2005 when Hurricane Katrina hit. When you mentioned Katrina, my ears perked up because I was born and raised in New Orleans. And although I wasn't living there at the time, watching my hometown flood and the death and destruction that followed, a real heartbreak for me. And that was my first awakening to the impacts of extreme weather and climate change. And then my own climate journey accelerated about 7 years ago, with the birth of the best-looking grandsons, twin grandsons, Gus and Bailey. And then of course, their cousin came along a couple years later, and then their little brother. So now I have four grandsons, age 7 and under. But what do those goofballs have to do with climate change? Well, it's easy for me to now picture what their lives will be in a relatively short time when they get to be my age, and what the world will be like, what the climate will be like for them, unless we make changes. So that's my climate journey. That's what's motivated me. And by the way, when we do our climate work, I start each of the workshops telling my own climate story. And I tell it because I want to make sure people understand I'm not a climate expert. I'm a psychologist who studies aging. But I ask the question, what can I do? What do I bring to this conversation? I did what you said, Alan. I started by looking around and starting where I was. And that's what each of us can do.
Indeed.
So I came to it very late.
Indeed, indeed. But let's go to the article a bit. Mick's article does this very well. So I'm not here to put you on the spot for the statistics and everything like that, but I do think it's important. I really like the way Mick set it up with a 10-word summary of climate change. And it's real, it's us, it's bad, and experts agree, and then there's hope. I thought that was very well laid out. Everybody should go to the article and read the data as written last year, at least. Any updates, Mick, or anything, any of those that you want to hit on a little more?
Sure, Alan. First, I want to be really clear. That 10-word summary I lifted from a colleague, Ed Myback, at George Mason University. Ed first came up with that framing, and he now actually has a 12-word summary, which I'll give you the other two words at the end. You're asking this question at a great time, because this week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just released its most recent report. This is a compilation of the consensus of the scientific community around the world and the political community around the world. So talk about updating my article from a year ago. IPCC just did it. And so let's run through the 10 words pretty quickly. It's real. The IPCC report leaves no doubt at all. As they put it, human activities have unequivocally caused global warming, and they go on to document the impacts of that. So it's real. Second, it's us, human activity, absolutely. Fossil fuel emissions set a record last year. At the very time that we're gathering data and acknowledging that fossil fuel use is a basic cause of our climate crisis, we're setting records for fossil fuel use, both in terms of coal and other things. It's bad. So what's bad about it? Well, you, Alan, gave a great example. Extreme weather events are happening all over the world. Our country is no exception. And when I talk with students, when I teach classes on this, I just ask people to give examples from their own experience. I had some students who were skeptical in a class one time, and a student from Florida said, "Are you kidding? Come to Florida. It's already happening here. Come see what flooding we have just with high tides." And I had another student from California say, "Are you kidding? Come see our droughts. Come see our wildfires. So it's bad. And if you ask people, don't ask people, is climate change happening as a human cause? Just say, have you noticed anything different? Just as you did, Alan. You said, I don't know. It's hard to say, but 10, 12 years ago, things started to change. A buddy of mine said to me, "I don't know about climate change." That was his way of saying, "I'm going to set the politics aside." But I can tell you, my buddies and I have been going to Canada every year on a fishing trip for 30 years. The streams are running different. The insects are different. The fish are different. What's he doing? He's doing just what you said at the beginning, Alan. He's looking around. He's seeing what's right around him in a part of the world that he's very familiar with. I talk to farmers. They say, "I don't know about climate change. That's their way of saying, let's put the politics aside. But I can tell you the crops are different. The rainfall is different. My growing season is different. They know something's changed. So it's bad. Experts agree. 97, 98% of climate scientists acknowledge that the climate crisis is human caused. Now, why is that important? Because that's what's called a gateway statistic. That is, once people understand that there's that much consensus, it tends to change their view on the climate crisis. You know, sometimes if you look at some of the debates on TV, you see one side is climate doubters, and then one side is climate folks who say climate crisis is real. But if you were really to have the statistics lined up, you'd have 97 people on one side and three on the other. And that 97% consensus is really an important piece of information. And then there's hope. Well, there's hope because we know that there are things that we can do. We also know that there are things we have done. Look at the cost of renewable energy, for example. Look at the uptake of renewables. Not that renewables will get us all the way that we need to go. They won't. But without them, we won't get there either. So there's hope in terms of our human agency and our capacity to take this on. Now, the two words that Ed Myback adds to make it a 12-word summary is we're together. Because we have a tendency to think, I'm in this alone. There's been recent research that suggests that people underestimate the extent to which other people share their climate concern. And it's pretty clear why. Because we have what I call a climate silence or a climate avoidance habit, and run something like this. Almost two-thirds of Americans say they're worried about climate change, according to the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. But only about a third of us ever talk to family members or friends about it. Mm-hmm. So two-thirds of us say, oh my gosh, I'm worried. But two-thirds of us also say, not going to talk about it. So how do we know that our concern is shared? And the habit loop goes something like this. Climate change, whoa, it's so big, what can one person do? It makes me anxious to just think about it. I'm just not going to talk or think about it. And as a result, we don't realize that we are in this together, as Ed Maybeck says, we're together.
Interesting.
Let me stop. That's the summary. And the only update is that the data are clearer and the IPCC has summarized it very well for us.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I wanted to combine a couple of questions together. I mean, I wanted to ask you, you know, for your reaction as to why there were only six people out there who had thought about climate change and older persons. Any insights as to why people didn't think about it? And then after that, let's dive into some of the things that some of the ideas that you talked about. For people of all generations, if you will, to engage in climate action together?
Well, sure. I think for one, I can think of a couple of reasons why more people had not looked at this until recently. And obviously it was more than six, but there weren't a lot of people out there. Mm-hmm. And I think Bill McKibben is a great example of this. Bill McKibben, as you know, is a well-known environmental activist and author, a leader in the environmental movement. Now, Bill turned 60 a couple of years ago. And at that point, he began to ask, how can we mobilize older adults? But until that time, he had not thought about older adults except as victims of climate change. And I think basically because the climate community didn't understand basic gerontology, which is that there's great variability among older adults. You take a group of 7-year-olds and a group of 77-year-olds. The 77-year-olds are much more diverse and different from each other than are the 7-year-olds. So to paint all older adults with one brush, that is victims of climate change, not climate activists, is just a mistake. Now, Bill understands that now, and that's why Third Act has been so successful with his leadership. So, but the other part is I think older adults themselves have been part of this process of saying, well, what can I do about climate change? Which many people of all ages are doing. That gets back to the climate avoidance habit. Well, what can one person do? What can I do? What do I bring to the table? I'm not a scientist. I'm not a geologist, a physicist, or whatever. And part of what we do in Growing Greener is help people cut through that and realize that we each bring to the table a set of assets. And older adults bring a variety of assets, including networks and knowledge and skills developed over a lifetime that they can apply to the climate crisis.
Let's jump to that then and talk a little more. I mean, and we can do it in the context of specifically what you're doing with Growing Greener and other parts of it. But in your article, you begin and you mentioned that older adults may have both a special responsibility and opportunity in responding to climate change. And you spend some time talking about some of the ways that older persons, who are able to do it, can engage with their networks and spheres of influence, and to assist in climate action. What are some of the things that older people can do? What are they doing through Growing Greener? And in particular, talk a little bit about some intergenerational types of things as well. So I gave you a lot there, and I'm going to give you a lot of time to talk about it. So
you packed a lot in there, Alan. Let me unpack.
I did.
I want to go back to where you started, which is that some people argue that older people have a special responsibility. My friend Rick Moody, who's a philosopher and a gerontologist, has made this argument for several years that particularly today's older adults who benefited from the energy economy that produced the climate crisis have a responsibility to pay back as much as they can in some way to help offset the benefits that they've received from that fossil fuel economy. The other thing is that older adults have great opportunities to respond. And the way that I think about it is that for many older adults, the climate crisis and the ability to respond to it aligns with also their developmental tasks, as the psychologists like to say. Because many older adults are at a phase of life where they're thinking about what's their sense of purpose in the last phase of life, and a sense of meaning beyond their own lifetimes. Clearly, responding to the climate crisis, I mentioned it in my own story, thinking about my grandkids and what I'm leaving to them. So getting older adults to respond and tapping into that sense of purpose and what Eric Erickson called generativity is really an important motivator for many older adults. So how do you do that? Well, you said it at the beginning, Alan, start where you are. So one of the things we emphasize in the work that we do is to get people to start where they are. It does no good to say, oh, I should have been vegan or, eating less meat for the last 50 years. There are no do-overs. So start where you are now, Meatless Mondays or whatever it is. So start where you are. But think about what are the resources that I bring to the conversation. And most of us say, what resources? I may not have money. Notice I didn't say money. I said resources. My students used to ask me, how do you know so many people? And I'd say, well, what do you mean? I said, well, if I ask you about any topic, somebody who works in that area. Or if I say, do you have any contacts in Austin? Well, yeah. Do you have contacts all over the country? I said, well, I've lived a long time. I've lived about three times as long as you have. So, I know a lot of people. Those are resources. Those are assets that I bring to any conversation I have. So when I'm in the room with a student, it's not just me, but it's my network of 500, 600. How many friends do you have on LinkedIn? Whatever it is, I bring that network. That's a resource that I bring to the table. And I'm not unique. Every older adult has a set of resources like that. Another set of resources that many older adults have is knowing how to get things done in a particular ecology, in a particular setting. I used to say to my grad students, look around any organization, understand the organization chart and the influence chart. The people who know how to get things done may not have a title, but they know how to get things done. When I was provost, my assistant knew how to get everything done everywhere. When I didn't know what to do, I'd say, Sue, how do we do this? And she would know exactly what to do. So if I were to get her engaged in climate change, she would bring that asset to the table, knowing how to get things done in that environment. So those are resources that we often overlook, particularly given the messages from society that, well, you know, you're old, what do you expect, you know? And the third thing is, because of the climate silence or climate avoidance habit, we don't share our concern and do brainstorming together. And this is true across generations, for example. We know from recent data that many younger adults are feeling both climate anxiety, and as much as 60% of United States young adults say they feel dismissed when they raise climate issues with people of a different generation. So this is a responsibility and an opportunity for older adults to be very active and supportive listeners, particularly to younger adults. And in the work that we've been doing most recently through Growing Greener, where we've been working with community groups of older adults, we have included intergenerational activities at the request of the older adults, and that has gone really well. It works out in different ways. Sometimes it's after our workshop, we give them the homework assignment of having a climate conversation with somebody from a younger generation. By the way, we did that with college students and had them do that over Thanksgiving with somebody from an older generation. But more recently, we've had two generations or more in the workshops together, and that has been really a very helpful process for both sides.
Mm-hmm. That's extremely important. I think that I had read, you know, apart from the journal, you know, about conversations, folks perhaps counseling younger climate activists to perhaps not as be as confrontational with boomers, to use a word which I don't like, but, you know, it's like kind of coming out of the box with you know, you terrible people, you did this, and et cetera, et cetera, and perhaps you know, be a bit try to be a bit more diplomatic, in the sense that somebody, say my age, might, if that's the first thing I hear, I confess might be a little like, whoa, you know, don't paint me with a brush like that, and let's talk and everything like that.
When I have those conversations with students, I really start in a couple of ways. One is, I say, well, let's look at the data. Let's be data informed. And as you know, in the ASA Generation Special Issue on Aging and the Climate Crisis, Jennifer Marlin from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication has a great article that shows the generational data on climate attitudes. And there basically are no significant differences across the mm-hmm. generations. It's not that the silent generation or the greatest generation or the boomers are in climate denial. It's just not the case. Mm-hmm. So first of all, be informed by the data. But secondly, think about what those older generations faced when they were your age. So yeah, no doubt about it, we have a climate crisis. No doubt about it, our generation has benefited from it. And by the way, when we were your age, what were we responding to that the previous generation had handed us? Well, we could talk about nuclear destruction. We could talk about the Vietnam War. So it's not that your challenge of climate crisis is any less. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying each generation has crises that they have to deal with. And we're most effective as a country and as a community when we do it together generationally rather than divisively.
Perfect. That's a great ending. That's a great way to end, I think. We've covered a lot of ground here. I think that you know, it's a great topic, and I've come to this recently. I think it's an important topic. It's something that ASA has clearly made a priority. And for those of you who are listening, you know, just if I may, if you're an ASA member or you know of ASA or whatever, and you're interested in climate change, we are looking for people who want to get involved, help with implementing some of the policy ideas that the ASA board has adopted and everything. So please contact ASA, reach out to us. And Mick, you know, give you a last, in terms of how can people get in touch with you, keep the conversation going? What can they do to help you?
Well, I appreciate your asking, Alan. They can reach me, Mick, M-I-C-K, at growing-greener.org, or go to our website, growing-greener.org. We're working with community partners and organizations across the country and in several other countries as well, trying to reach people to move them from anxiety to action. We do that in a very simple way. It takes under 40 minutes. And by the end of that time, we've broken that climate avoidance habit, and people are asking, what can we do together? And that leads to much bigger outcomes for us.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you for joining us today. And be sure to check out our publications at generations.asaging.org. And as said during this podcast, keep the conversation going and start where you are.